We are going to talk with NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations this hour, who is in Wisconsin this week. He's in Madison, talking with news reporters and editors about putting together better stories about race and diversity. And he is going to be moderating a forum in Madison tonight on talking across the social divide. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we will wonder from you if what you think media's role is in bridging the social divide. We will wonder if you see or read or hear examples of news coverage that perpetuate stereotypes or break them down. We will wonder if you think our media should be doing something more to increase understanding, to increase voices of diversity in the coverage of issues. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Keith Woods. He is NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations. Good morning.
Good morning, and it's great to see you again, Joy.
Yes, it's good to have you back in Madison. First of all, just to remind our listeners, what do you do as NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations?
Well, I tell my children that I meet every day, often. That's what I do. But the real work of my job is pretty much to help our organization and to help public radio across the system to get better at bringing in the fullest range of voices in America so that when we talk about the public in public radio, we really do mean the full public.
Yeah. And I know that Wisconsin Public Radio has partnered with the Capital Times in Madison to bring you back to talk with, for that matter, I was at a seminar yesterday on doing better stories on race and diversity. But you are also going to be hosting or moderating a forum tonight on communicating across the social divide in Madison. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you intend to do?
Well, sure. The reason that Paul Fanlon asked me to do this particular thing was that because of the conversation that's sprung up after the Race to Equity report came out in the fall, there's a lot of interest in having discussions around the issues of race and ethnicity in the area and in the state, and he asked me to be a part of something. And my suggestion was that since I am not a Madisonian, I do not live in Wisconsin, the specifics of the issues in the state are not my area of expertise. But I've spent a great deal of time helping people in communities and helping journalists to get better at talking across these various chasms in our society that are related to race and ethnicity. And my view is real simple, Joy. If we can't do that very simple thing, we can't do our jobs well as journalists. We certainly cannot do our jobs well as members of a society. And so all of the other things that we're trying to do will ultimately be challenged by these very simple problems that we have in communication.
Yeah, and the chasms that we see in Madison, though you don't live here, are all over the country.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a national phenomenon. It is. It's an international phenomenon. And so a lot of the things that we'll be talking about tonight are pretty much transferable anywhere you might go.
Well, this Race to Equity report that came out last fall for Dane County, I think, shocked a lot of people. A lot of people thought that, yes, they knew there were racial disparities in education and in the prison population, income and other areas. But I think some thought, well, that's someplace else. It's not right here in liberal Madison, and
sure.
And it is. I mean, it's among the worst in the country in liberal Madison. What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, first you have to realize that, like many other areas in our country in our history around disparities and oppression and all the other things that are true about our country's history, the people who were affected by it knew it a long time ago. And so there, you have this dissonance already existing in the city and in the area where there are people who say, "Oh my God, is that true?" And then there are other people who say, "Weren't you listening? We've been saying this for a long time." And again, I think that that's very much a part of the challenge that we have in communication. Is it, you know, what's going on isn't that there are people who have been, you know, living with their heads under rocks. It is that the disconnect between how I view myself or how I as a county view myself and what my the truth of my existence is don't always match up.
Yeah. And while people are well-meaning, that's not enough.
Right. And we were talking yesterday about this notion of commitment and the dissonance that, that exists there between the people who believe that commitment means not doing harm and the people who believe that commitment means actually working against problems. And if I have one of those views, if I believe I'm doing very well because I am not hurting anyone and I teach my children to not hurt anyone, then I'm doing fine. And the challenge is that there are other folks who believe that if you're not actively working against it, you are part of the problem.
Yeah. So what is the media's role in trying to bridge these chasms in race and ethnicity?
Well, I would take a little bit of motivation out of that and say that the media's role is to reflect a truth about the people in the community so that the people will have a full understanding of their value, their qualities and their problems and can act accordingly. So our role isn't to make things better. Our role is to provide people with the truth, a real full understanding of what's going on in society so that we don't reach this point where we say, "Oh my God, is that true?" It is our role to ring the bell.
Mm-hmm. And the bell has been rung to some extent. Now what? I mean,
well, you know, we were talking yesterday about the full range of responsibility that journalism has here. And a big part of it is to recognize that we are, you know, one of our roles is to hold the powerful accountable, right? But we are the powerful. And the accountability to media is to understand that if you provide people with a steady drumbeat of pathology on one end of the continuum about one group of people and a fuller, more a 360-degree view of others, and we do that by race, by class, by gender, by sexual orientation, we do it in a lot of different ways, then we're actually providing an untruth. And that does harm. And ethics demand that you minimize harm.
Well, you know, you told a story yesterday at a seminar that I attended with other reporters on reporting better stories on race and ethnicity. The story about your son, who's talk about that. About, you know, he's a pretty good student.
Right. So I have a 13-year-old middle schooler, and I still have all of my hair in spite of that. And he's a straight A student. Has been a straight A student all of his life. He attends a magnet program. I live in Tampa, Florida, and he is surrounded in that program in a bubble by lots of other kids, most of them who are white. My son is an African American, who are academically the same. They go to school in an impoverished area. And so many of the students in outside of the bubble, most African-American or Latino, who are not achieving academically, are the rest of that reality. But he lives in a world in which, in his family and in his extended family, in which achievement is normal. But the media picture that he consumes, because we are drawn to things that break in the media, is one of young black people who are not succeeding or who are succeeding against some great odds. My son does not have great odds provided by his family situation or his economic situation or his academic situation. It would be good if he saw the rest of the story, not all the time, but enough of the time.
Yeah. And so it does harm if we're not telling your son's story.
Absolutely, because you don't know my son's story either. And your expectation of what a young African-American child can achieve can easily be bent by the picture that we are providing if that picture suggests to always regard him as in need of help.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the coverage that I have seen and participated in when it comes to, for example, the performance gap or the achievement gap in our schools focuses on the poverty that many African-American children are living in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, in Madison, and how that would affect their grades.
Yeah.
And we should cover that, shouldn't we?
Well, absolutely. And it's interesting, though, that we conflate the race and class issues in that storytelling so that you can't tell the difference anymore, and you equate underachievement with their race, where study after study after study tells us that if we did something about poverty, those disparities would begin to disappear. Now, they do not go away completely because we do have work to do on race and racism and prejudice, but they would be extremely minimized if we could attack poverty. So in some ways, if we can take that transient state, which is your social class, and make it the focus of our efforts. I do not advocate silencing ourselves on race, but if we focused our efforts on that transient state, then we wouldn't identify people by something like race as pathologized as we tend to do, and that is a media phenomenon.
Yeah, but these reports that we see, like Wisconsin having the worst record in terms of incarceration disparities, more African Americans in prison here than per capita than anywhere in the country, and these education gaps. I mean, we need to be reporting on them. But you're saying don't do this. Don't focus so much on the race aspect, but something else.
Well, I would say recognize that every time we tell that story, it's a complex story, and even though if you're an African American in Wisconsin, your alarm bells are going off as an African American because you see this phenomenon playing out. But think about it this way. If we said that the fact that women earn, is it 77 cents on a dollar for every man, and we said that is a problem because they're women, and we kept telling you that it's because they're women that they are not earning that much as men. Well, first of all, you're not going to stop being a woman, and therefore you are stuck with the notion that you can't earn more. Not because of the prejudices in our society against women, but because of the fact that you're a woman. And that's what happens with race and crime. It isn't about being black. And if we can help people to understand that, then we can bifurcate this conversation in a more nuanced way so that we are not equating the criminal problem with someone's race as though the genes pumped into their body at birth turned them into that, and not all of these other factors that study after study after study tells us is responsible.
Well, what other stories are we not seeing enough of or hearing enough of when dealing with these issues?
Well, you know, in terms of disparities, in terms of these, you know, education issues and health issues and so on, each of them has three, four, or five different narratives that we could follow and begin to discern the difference between true problem and something small enough that we can let go. So in some ways, it isn't that there are a ton of other racial issues that we're not covering. It's that we are often either oversimplifying it and saying that it is this, the disparities are because there are bad teachers in the system, and so we wind up with policies that go after teachers, or it's the problem is that it's class size, and the only thing we do is mandate X number of students in a class. It is a complex issue, and I would say media's job is to keep telling people that.
and do a comprehensive job of covering all of those voices.
Over time. We can't do it all in every story.
Right. We are talking about media coverage of race and ethnicity issues and other issues of diversity with Keith Woods, who is NPR's Vice President of Diversity. And we are welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming examples of media coverage that you think is doing it right, and maybe that's not doing it right. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Madison is turning a scrutinizing eye to its own race issues. Coming up tonight with a panel intended to address talking across the social divide between different groups. We are talking with the NPR Vice President of Diversity, who will be moderating this forum, and we're talking about the media's role in improving conversations about race and racism. And we're welcoming your questions for Keith Woods at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Keith Woods is Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations at National Public Radio or NPR. Let's go to the phones. Tony in Madison is with us. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thanks both for having the show. My biggest question is, I don't see equity in our media. I don't hear the voice of color anywhere in our media. And as you guys said earlier, you should be reflecting the truth. I would love to see WPR step up to that challenge and put the voice of color somewhere on the radio, somewhere in the media within the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I this comes up all the time, and I'm glad it did. Let me just say, Wisconsin Public Radio does have a Latina host. Veronica Rickard, who hosts Central Time, is Latina. Jonathan Overby, who hosts Higher Ground, is African American. Robin Cherry, my producer, and to be fill-in host, is African American. Not that we're perfect by any means, but there is some voice of color on Wisconsin Public Radio, Tony, and I appreciate you bringing up the subject, though. Keith Woods, that's part of what you also do in your job at NPR.
Yeah, it's absolutely central to my work, and among the many things that I do with public radio stations across the country is try to let people know about people. So there's a lot of brokering of information around the journalists across the system to help stations as they try to bring greater diversity to the air. And when you think about that, I mean, there are some direct and indirect benefits of having that kind of racial and ethnic diversity. There is a symbolic level, and I always tell people, don't underestimate the power of that. It's simply hearing somebody who sounds like you, seeing somebody who looks like you, allows people to feel a connection to your organization and listen better when they're listening. So symbolism is important. You can't guarantee that every time you put a woman on the air, every time you put a black man on the air, that you're going to get the benefit of gender or race from their presence there. Not everybody feels their difference the same way, and not everybody lives it the same way. But you increase the chances every time you bring greater diversity, whatever it is, to the staff. You increase the chance that you're going to hear something you haven't been hearing. You're going to get a perspective on something you don't have yourself. And in our greater pursuit of the truth, you're getting closer.
Yeah. Well, I can also talk a little bit about being a woman on Wisconsin Public Radio. When I took over for a long time male host of this show, there were some, I mean, I'm not necessarily a pioneer in the women's movement, but starting off in broadcasting, there was a lot of different attitudes out there. Some people said, "Oh, now you're going to feminize the coverage. You're going to talk about, you know, homes and gardens and not talk about politics." And so, I certainly understand that having a woman on the air is important too, and having voices of people people of different races and ethnicities is important too. But and I'm wondering though, Keith Woods, if we have you know, half a dozen talk shows on Wisconsin Public Radio, which is a lot more than most other stations, should we have a member of a different you know, minority group hosting each? How does the station deal with that kind of stuff?
Well, again, I think it's, you know, you got to look at everything that we're doing across a long term, not any individual snapshot, because in every organization there are so many seats and the faces occupying those seats change all the time. So your goal, I think, is not any particular status that you've achieved and you're done. Your goal is to be able to say over time that the audience is hearing from that range. And at the same time, and this is as important to me, the people who are there at the moment, whoever they are, whatever they represent, are endeavoring to bring much more beyond themselves to the air. So that if I'm an African American, I do not know the Native American experience, and I can't presume to be able to speak for that group. What am I doing to learn more so that I can speak more intelligently and to bring voices in myself so that I can play a part in that greater diversity? So it's not simply a matter of being African American. It's understanding that if you're not, that there are things you don't know that you've got to learn, and that there are voices that you can bring in, people to speak for themselves, and you have the power to do that in that role.
Yeah, bringing on guests.
Sure, absolutely. Or covering topics that are more important to that group than to another group.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that is important for all media to be participating in terms of you want to be hearing from, and you were talking about this, yes, the authentic voice.
Right. Yeah. Right. And people will recognize, you know, I often hear people, especially in radio, say, well, how will they know? I don't have a Latino last name. I don't speak with an accent. How will they know? Well, I recognize when you speak authentically about an experience, and there's a point at which it doesn't matter. If you can reach the point where you can speak authentically about something, you really know it well, then that's what I want to feel and hear as a listener. It isn't just knowing the color of your skin.
Let's go to Hugh in Milwaukee next. Hello, Hugh.
Hi. Well, I thoroughly disagree with your guest today. I hope at one point you might have a guest like Colin Flaherty, who has a book called White Girl Bleed a Lot, on how the media covers up black incidents of violent racism against white people, and how even in Milwaukee, the chief of police lied about an incident of New Year's Eve, I think it was, or July 4th, and the mayor, they lie. They want the pretty picture instead of the real picture. Even Obama, when he marched with the members of the new Black Panther Party, some of whom advocate the extermination of the white race, that was not covered by your liberal media.
Well, Hugh's viewpoint is that we're going out of our way, the media in general, and not covering this these issues that would put, I guess, African Americans in a bad light.
Well, African Americans might spend a lot of time arguing that point, but here's the I think where there is often a disconnect in this. Plays out across race. It also plays out across ideology. In society today, a lot of times where the media gets it wrong in racial incidents is when it assumes a racial motive in cases that are just about violence. And that happens, I think, whether it's black people attacking white people or white people attacking black people. But there are also a lot of folks in our society who think that every time a person of one race has attacked a person of another race, that it's a racial incident. And in the event that there are black criminals who have attacked white people, if it is in fact because they wanted to get white people, hopefully the police have figured that out and told the media, and then the media tells you. More often, I would venture, it's criminals attacking victims. And if the person who was walking down the street at that moment happened to be Asian, it would have still been a crime, but not necessarily a racial crime. And I think that that's where we can pull this stuff apart better in our discourse.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the coverage of the knockout game? What I found strange about that is that that knockout game wasn't necessarily a new thing, and all of a sudden there's this big push, and we saw story after story about, you know, the supposedly black kids punching and beating a white victim.
Right.
What was going on there?
Well, I have to say, you know, so I work in Washington, D.C., and there was a moment, I guess it was last summer, when this thing went really viral. Mm-hmm. And I was a victim, in a sense, of the coverage of this, because my sense of security was completely destabilized by this. You know, I'm a middle class black man walking down the street in neighborhoods where there are people of, you know, across the class continuum. And I worried about getting attacked. And then the more you read and study the issue, the more you understand that there were, in fact, incidents that were real incidents that happened, that were repeated and magnified and in the media in a way that made what was a small phenomenon. There are, in fact, bigots in our society, and they do bigoted things. But to turn it into this massive, outsized fear, I think is very much a phenomenon of media. And what we do with many of those kinds of stories is, even the organizations that have a higher threshold for news than some of the lower brow journalists among us, are eventually forced into the story because social media has taken it and turned it into something bigger, and it is now being talked about so much that people are turning to your organization and someone else's organization and saying, why aren't you talking about this? And then we're dragged in to the phenomenon, and what happens is that people's sense of security is destabilized unnecessarily.
Yeah. You talked a little bit in our seminar yesterday on reporting better stories. The police, when they issue a description of a suspect of a crime, and how useless it is and maybe dangerous it is to include race in those descriptions. Talk some about that.
Right. There are third rail issues in our business, and this is one of them. Mm-hmm. But let me just say that we believe that when we give somebody a racial description, that we have told someone what someone looks like. And in fact, for the most part, if you use the word white to describe a white person, the continuum of complexion that is attempting to cover is pretty large. And all of the features of the person that have to go into filling out that description have to be assumed by the person who's hearing it. So white people have white people's eyes and white people's noses and white people's ears and white people's lips. Unless we're different. And if we're different, then that description actually doesn't do anybody any good. So when you say you're looking for a black male, does he look like me with light brown skin and dark hair? He had some dark hair. Now it's mostly gray. And, you know, eyebrows and ears and so on. Or does he look like Denzel Washington? I kind of wish I did look like Denzel Washington, but you see the point.
Yeah. And so just keep race out of it. Just say that the police are looking for a suspect in a badger sweatshirt, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and who has light brown skin? If I suddenly told you that I was Muslim, if I suddenly told you that I was Latino, if I suddenly told you that my mother was Native American, I would still look exactly the same. All of my features would be the same. So unless my race informs something about how I look specifically, It is irrelevant. It is never a description of how someone looks.
And Hugh's call reminded me a little bit about this because one of the reporters said when we leave race out of a description in a newspaper story, we'll get calls from readers saying, why did you leave that out? What are you trying to hide or do or censor?
Well, sure, because people have made an association between race and pathology, the assumption is that we're trying to hide the pathology of the race. We're trying to hide the fact that they are exactly what we've been saying they are. And as I said yesterday, we did the same thing in the media with AIDS and sexual orientation. I mean, in the beginning of our coverage of that topic, we would tell people all the time, when we told someone that someone had AIDS, we would also find a way in the story to tell them that they were gay, so that we could either reinforce the view of people that that was their issue, their disease, and not ours, or we would comfort ourselves that way by reminding ourselves that we were safe. And then one day the media figured it was doing that and stopped doing it. I think we could learn the same lesson about race and ethnicity and identifications and start telling people truly helpful information.
Many callers, Sheree in Waupun. Hello, Sheree.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Great show as well, as usual. And Mr. Woods, nice to hear from you today. I live in a little small town where it's not quite rural, but it's definitely not an urban town. And we have a large prison population here because we have several prisons. And so the challenge that I run into as a female here in Waupun is that, first of all, they assumed that I was here because I was visiting someone in the prison when that wasn't the case. So once we kind of got past that, it really kind of turned into, well, we like having you here because you're different than the rest of them. You know, the only news that we get is the Milwaukee news or sometimes the Madison news. But if the Milwaukee news is highlighting, you know, any urban problems or shootings, then it's automatically assumed that they were black. And then when you have the prisons here and the parents working in the prisons here, and the only, you know, real sense that they get of black people are working with them at the prison, you know, for me, it almost seems like I'm climbing an uphill battle because I have to change the mind of the people who work at the prison and who bring that home to their kids. And then that affects my daughter. It affects me. I have to go 50 miles out of my way for hair products, which sounds silly because no one else would have to do that, but I have to do that. You know, and you can't be mad at ignorance because you can't get mad if a sailor doesn't know how to tie a square knot. But we are so ignorant in this society. We're so scared to talk about race that you can't. I mean, I get constantly asked, should I say African-American or black? And I'll say, you know, you realize that black African-Americans in ethnicity, black is the race. And then that confuses the whole situation. And we literally, people just stay away from it because it's uncomfortable. But they don't realize that until we get past that uncomfortability about it, there won't be much change. And change needs to happen.
Oh, Sheree, thank you so much for bringing up these issues. We've got to put Sheree on hold and see if she wants to come on and be a guest sometime, I think, because she calls in quite often about various issues. But Keith Woods, you want to respond to?
Sure. And I think you know, there's a lot there. And one of the things that one of the pieces of work that I do, Joy, with journalists and with people in the public is to try to help us manage these conversations ourselves first. So this isn't about fixing the other people. It's about figuring out how to be in these conversations ourselves so that we come out of it whole, not feeling compromised, not feeling broken as a result of it. So first, understanding that this is, if somebody has, if somebody's ignorant, it isn't your fault, nor is it your responsibility to help them to get somewhere else. But what you can do is recognize that we all come into one of these exchanges, whether it's over race or ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation or something else, with ignorance. So there is a time when I am ignorant. I may be really knowledgeable about this one, but on the next one, I don't have nearly the same information. There's a bit of patience that comes with that. There's a bit of tolerance that comes with that. And then figuring out how to use questions to help people to figure their own way out. So when somebody says, is it African American or black? My question might be, why does it matter? And ask people to get into a conversation about the discomfort that they have in trying to find the right language. Because what's underneath that question is all about my sense of ignorance and my sense of doubt in having a conversation across difference. So there's a lot there in what she's saying.
Yeah.
And it could be a show by itself.
I was going to say we could go talk the rest of the show about that, but we will move on to other callers who have other issues that they would like to bring up. We are talking with Keith Woods. He is the Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations at NPR. In Madison today, because he's going to be moderating a forum tonight in Madison, attended to address communicating across the social divide. And we'll talk more about that coming up. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Keith Woods, who is NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations. I just mentioned, Keith Woods, that On Point's going to be talking about affirmative action in our next hour. We're talking a little bit about affirmative action policies in Wisconsin in light of the Supreme Court decision that was handed down this week regarding Michigan. We have a state senator who says we should have a constitutional amendment in Wisconsin to ban affirmative action or to ban the consideration of race in college admissions and other, other government policies. So how should the media deal with that issue?
Well, like many other issues, you can talk about that at a pure policy level and miss the story that's behind the court's decision. Miss the levels of the story. And we were talking earlier about the need to step back and ask first, what are we trying to achieve and why are we trying to achieve it? So when you think about something like affirmative action, why did it come into being in the first place? What was the goal then? What's the situation today? And if we wanted to achieve the goal that was behind affirmative action, or maybe we don't, but if we did, what's the answer? So it's a way of pulling back from the yes-no dichotomy around the issue itself, because if societies are going to make decisions about something as profound as that, you want them to go in armed with deep and rich information upon which to make that choice.
Let's go to another caller, Jerry in Milwaukee. Hello, Jerry.
Good morning. How are you, Troy?
Good.
And Mr. Wood. You know, I agree, Mr. Woods, with a lot of what you say, with most of what you say. However, I would take it a step further, and not only regarding race issues discussed in the media, but all issues. I'll give an example. I often wondered, for instance, Joy, when you say, tell Joy where to go, for instance. If I went up, as an African-American, if I went up north, wanted to spend a week in the cabin country, northern Wisconsin, would I, as an African American, be welcome? And the only way for me to know that is to have diversity in people who travel there, who happen to be minority, Hispanic, what have you, to see. Because, you know, the experience I might get as an African American in Green Bay or up north might be totally different than majority population. But that's just one instance. It applies to economic discussion, it applies to food discussion, it applies to everything. I think there needs to be more at the table, more people of color at the table, as well as expanding the Rolodex used by media. In other words, the same people are called over and over again, if it's minority in particular, as opposed to expanding the talking heads. And there are enough minority professors, economic people, bankers around America to do that, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah.
Oh. So, NPR is guilty as well. And the problem I have with NPR is that it's subsidized by government, which is me.
Well, Jerry, and I appreciate, and I know that Keith doesn't know maybe what you mean by tell Joy where to go. I have an hour on Fridays where we do talk about things going on around Wisconsin, and it might be, you know, some tell me where to go to get some good cheese or whatever. And
in Wisconsin? Yeah, oh, that's a struggle.
But Jerry's saying that, and I'm trying to get this, you're trying to say maybe I should... How would I do that differently, Jerry, if I...
Well, I would say that, you know, for instance, I should have people of color, Hispanics, blacks, on air, who have visited, for instance, some of the places they've gone to that you mentioned up north, whether they would feel welcome, and they would know that immediately. So the experience, what I'm saying is the experience that I might encounter in Green Bay or other places up north, then the majority person... would be totally different in terms of wanting to spend my time and dollars there.
Yeah.
And that's the only way that could be addressed is by actually having people like me or Hispanic or whomever, Native Americans, to actually experience that. So how that's implemented,
I get where you're coming from, Jerry. But he wants to hear more of the authentic voices talking about their experiences.
And I would take it a step further, Joy, and say that that we tend in our we generally tend as human beings to see the experiences that we have as representative. So that if somebody calls you up and says, "Let me tell you a great B&B to go to." In northern Wisconsin, and you say, well, what made it great? And they tell you all these wonderful things. Well, if they're a white person who has gone and had that experience, mm-hmm. I think what he's saying is that it could have been a completely different experience if it was an African American who had gone. And until you've heard from more people about the experience, it's hard if I'm African American to take too much information from that. Because I'm perhaps worried that I'm going to run into racism when I go, and the person who's calling you to tell you it was a great experience wouldn't. And I think that that's, you know, in some ways, the greater the diversity of voices on the air, the greater the possibility that we'll get those sorts of complex views of things to allow people to have better information to make their decisions. And, he mentioned sourcing as an issue. And again, it's one of the things that I do. And at NPR, we've just completed a look at our sourcing in some ways found some of the things that we knew we would find when we looked. But we discovered far fewer women sources and fewer women expert sources than we thought we had. Far more white sources than people of color than we thought we had. And the listeners who hear this recognize it. Changing that takes work. And I think that kind of is at the core of a lot of what we're talking about with the media. We believe good things about ourselves. And a lot of times that's enough for us. We think we've done the work because we haven't done harm. But to have this level of inclusion takes constant work, especially if it doesn't happen in your life ordinarily every day anyway. So if we become more vigilant about that kind of inclusion, it will happen more often. But it will never be, maybe never is too big of a word, but it will be a while before it's easy.
Yeah. Do you think, Keith, that we should, or I should in particular, since I do a call-in show, and we've heard from someone like Jerry who says he'd like to hear more voices like him talking about experiences in Wisconsin, maybe I should actually do a special call-out to listeners in some cases. If you are... an African American who, you know, should I specifically call for people to call in and talk about their experiences?
Well, I would say it's an option. It's an option available to all of us in journalism to essentially tell people you're welcome here more actively. I wouldn't have a problem, and obviously Jerry doesn't either, calling into your show. But there are a lot of people out there who feel maybe because they don't speak well, maybe because they don't hear people who sound like them on the radio, that's not something that they should do. I think actively going after the diversity that we want is always a good thing, and it doesn't exclude anybody else. You're not telling white people we don't want you just because you're telling African Americans we would like you to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah. Well, we are almost out of time now already. What is it that you hope can be accomplished by tonight's forum, Bridging the Social Divide?
So we have 90 minutes to try to get at something that is as old as the country. My hope is to give people tools that are transferable beyond the evening's conversation, a way of thinking about this that is a little different than maybe the way they were thinking about it coming in, and a few tools to try out once they leave. Because if we can just commit ourselves to getting better at this, I think that we will be able to tackle and permanently tackle some of these things that keep coming back up in our society.
What are the next steps in improving our conversations?
Well, a little bit of honesty in our conversations with one another, a little bit of preemptive trust, sort of trusting somebody before they've given you a reason to trust them, and being a little bit more candid in our conversations, a little bit more tolerant and patient when we bump into the people who don't know. And for those of us who are the people who don't know, a little bit more active pursuit of knowledge than what maybe we've generally been doing.
Yeah, we still have about a minute to
sure.
go. I know you've been working on these types of issues pretty much all of your career.
Yes.
Talked about a project that you led in your home state of Louisiana. Are you optimistic that we're finally serious about this?
Well, I think that I'm optimistic because you know the sun comes up the next day, and you have to be in anything that you're doing in this country optimistic, you know, in order to feel like you can get something done. What we have to recognize is that progress will be in fits and starts, and every time there's an opportunity, and maybe there is one now in Madison, but every time there's an opportunity to move, you jump in with both feet.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Keith Woods is NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations. Again, he is hosting, he is moderating this forum tonight at the First Unitarian Church in Madison, Together Apart, Talking Across the Social Divide. There's more information about it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, and I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time. It's the Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political perspectives talking about the top news in politics this week. That's the Week in Review tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.